S-Y and Emmanuel, a biblical drama. Act 1, setting the scene, Judah and Israel.
This drama, found in the book of Isaiah, the prophet, took place at a particularly bad time in the history of Judah and Israel.
That's the same thing, isn't it?
No, it isn't. Oh, wait a minute. Who are you?
I'm an interested party.
An interested party? Wait a minute. Have you got a sister?
Certainly. Why?
I think I met her over another episode from the Bible.
Could be. She's very interested in things.
Well, she was quite irritating at times. Though she did have some good insights at times as well.
I sometimes have good insights.
I find that hard to believe. Well, anyway, your first contribution was not correct. Judah and Israel were not always the same people.
How's that then?
Well, if you keep quiet for a minute, I'll explain. We are going back to the days of King Solomon.
Act 2. Flashback to the days of King Solomon.
Back to Solomon? That doesn't sound interesting.
Are you interested in paying taxes?
Well, if I use a taxi, then I should think I should pay the driver.
No, not paying for taxi journeys. Paying income tax and other taxes.
I'm certainly not interested in that. I pay them because I have to, but I'd rather not, thank you very much.
Well, that was part of the trouble back in Solomon's time as well.
Really?
Oh, yes. When Solomon became king, he undertook massive building projects that had to be paid for by raising taxes to pay for them. Taxes back then could be paid in gold or silver, or with produce such as the share of a person's crops, or in being conscripted to work part-time in construction projects, on top of doing your own work and earning your own living. And that's what Solomon did.
Building things? Like what?
Well, one huge project was building a second palace for his wives and concubines.
How many did he have?
700 wives and 300 concubines.
Oh, that would be expensive.
Don't interrupt. The palace was built largely due to Solomon's marriage to the daughter of the Egyptian pharaoh. You can imagine that this did not go over well with taxpayers, who wondered why he married her in the first place. People in Israel were obviously questioning it, because Solomon felt compelled to publicly justify its construction. But it would have sounded lame. Here's what he said.
My wife must not live in the palace of David, king of Israel, because the places the ark of the Lord has entered are holy.
That was a quick flashback. It sounded like an excuse to me.
Exactly. There was a lot of unrest. And to add to the tension, the 10 tribes who lived in the northern parts of the kingdom were unhappy at what they saw as the unfair privilege being taken by Judah in the south of the kingdom, and especially the house of David.
But he was their king, chosen by the Lord himself.
Yes, but that didn't stop questions about it. They weren't all convinced that this was the Lord's will and work. There was a deep resentment in the north about the power and privilege in the south.
Bit like Scotland and England, then. So, what happened when Solomon died?
Ah, an intelligent question.
Thank you.
When Solomon's son, Rehoboam, became king, he was aware that resentment was brewing in Israel over his father's burdensome taxes. And he had a rival for the loyalty of the northern tribes.
Was it Isaiah?
No, of course it wasn't Isaiah. This was ages before Isaiah.
Who was it then?
It was a tribal leader called Jeroboam. He was considered the natural leader of the northern tribes, and they rallied around him.
He must have been important. He gave his name to a big bottle of wine.
Trust you to know that.
Thank you.
Jeroboam had been living in Egypt, having fled there from Solomon. But now he saw his chance to get changes made. So he returned to Jerusalem when Solomon died.
It's all getting a bit tense.
It certainly was. Jeroboam and a bunch of leaders had an audience with Rehoboam. Let's listen in.
Act 3. Flashback to the days of Rehoboam.
Greetings, Rehoboam, my king.
Greetings, Jeroboam, my honoured guest. How may I assist you?
Your father Solomon put a heavy tax yoke on us, but if you will now lighten the harsh labour and the heavy yoke, we will serve you.
That sounds a little like an ultimatum. This requires some serious consideration. Give me 3 days to discuss this with my advisers, and I will respond properly to you then.
They left the court, and Rehoboam consulted with the court elders who had advised his father, Solomon.
How would you advise me to respond to these people who have made this challenge to my authority?
My king, this is a great opportunity. If you act generously to these people and give them a favourable response, they will surely serve you well and faithfully.
Then I should bow to the wishes of my subjects.
But my king...
Enough. Your advice has been heard. Leave now.
What happened next? This was brewing up to a bad outcome.
Quite. Rehoboam wanted his own way, and that was a way of unchallenged power and privilege. But he wanted to hear others agreeing with him as well, so he called for his young friends who shared his love of power and privilege. He knew he could count on them. Let's listen in.
I have just had Jeroboam and a group of tribal leaders from the north tell me that I need to draw back from my ongoing building program, solidify my position as king if I want their loyalty as my servants. What do you say to that?
My king, it is hard to believe that they would presume to speak to you in this way. It would be within your right to punish them.
And what punishment do you have in mind?
My king, I would advise you to call their bluff and make them long for the easier days of your father. Tell them that you are even stronger than your father, that you have more power in your little finger than he had in his whole body. Tell them that you will make their yoke even heavier than it was. Make them realize the horror of their mistakes by telling them that whereas your father ordered the overseers to scourge them with whips, you will have them scourged with scorpions.
That's terrible. What did Rehoboam reply?
Nothing. He smiled. And he waited quietly for the 3 days to pass. And sure enough, Jeroboam and his men returned to the court. Let's listen in.
Act 4. 3 days later.
Greetings, Rehoboam, my king.
Greetings, Jeroboam. My honoured guest, I see that you have returned as I commanded.
I saw it more of an invitation, my king.
Did you? Well, I have considered your proposal, and I have an answer for you.
Yes, my king.
I agree that it is not appropriate to continue the arrangement that my father, King Solomon, began. It is no longer enough to satisfy my own arrangements. I will make your yoke even heavier than it was. My father had you scourged with whips, but I will scourge you with scorpions.
You dare treat us like this?
I do not dare. I am your king. You have dared to question my rule.
Then we have nothing left to discuss. We will have nothing more to do with you and your precious dynasty. Return to your tents, men of the north, men of Israel. Prepare to leave this place and its king. You can rule your own house, son of David, but you will not rule ours.
I can't believe it. I didn't know about this. They just left and set up their own kingdom in the north.
Yes, exactly so. They went home, and shortly afterwards the northern tribes made Jeroboam their king.
So it really is true that Judah and Israel were not always the same group of people in biblical narratives.
Yes, it is true. And it is very important that we absorb that fact and remember it when we read passages in the Hebrew Bible, especially in the books of the prophets. Some of those prophets lived and served God in Judah, and some in Israel.
At least it was a bloodless separation.
Hardly. There were still northern people living and working in Judean towns. But when Rehoboam sent men to enforce the forced labour on them, they rebelled and killed them, even the overseer who had been appointed by the king himself.
Did it settle down then?
Not at first. Rehoboam was so angry that he started mustering an army to march on the northern tribes and retake the territory. But a prophecy from the Lord warned him against it, and he stood the army down.
So, there was nearly a civil war back at that time.
Yes, civil war was averted. But the deep-seated enmity was there for all to see. It would burst out later, in the days of Ahaz and Isaiah.
Well, this is all quite shocking and very interesting, I'm sure. But when can we get to the juicy bit?
The juicy bit?
Yes, you said this was going to be about something found in the book of Isaiah. He was a prophet, right?
Yes, of course.
And if my memory serves me right, he said some of the big prophecies about Jesus, the coming Messiah, right? The ones we enjoy at Christmas, right?
Well, yes, actually. That's quite impressive, your knowing that.
Well then, let's get to a prophecy.
We are getting to a prophecy, a famous messianic prophecy. But we needed those flashbacks first. It really is important to have an idea of what was going on if we want to understand the full significance of the prophecy.
Okay.
Act 5. Setting the scene again.
We can now go to the main event of this piece. We turn to Isaiah chapter 7. There are some very powerful symbolic names in this passage, and they don't all belong to the heroes.
I was going to ask you about that. About the title of this piece that you are doing.
Oh, were you?
Yes, I've heard of Emmanuel, but who? Oh, what the heck is S-Y?
And we mustn't forget Tabeel.
Who?
Exactly.
Well, who are they?
As I was saying, we can now go to the main event of this piece.
Act 6. The Days of King Ahaz and the prophet Isaiah.
Ahaz became the king of Judah.
That's the kingdom in the south, based in Jerusalem.
I know that. Why are you still here?
I'm more interested than ever.
Wonderful. Now, at this point, the king of Israel, the kingdom in the north, before you say it, was Pekah. He felt that the time was right to put things right, as he saw it, and march on Jerusalem. He wanted to capture the southern kingdom, to unite all the tribes again under his authority.
So the civil war had actually come to the people of God.
Yes. It was a terrible time in the story of our faith.
Well, the northern kingdom had 10 tribes against 2 southern tribes. But were they strong enough to win a war against Judah?
Another intelligent question.
Thank you.
No, they weren't strong enough. So he formed an alliance with a neighbouring king, Rezin. He was the king of Aram, which is roughly the area that we know today as Syria. He had eyes on Jerusalem as well. King Ahaz was really disturbed when he heard about this alliance. He knew they were in trouble.
But wasn't the Lord protecting the house of David and Jerusalem?
He certainly was. And so we come to the build-up to the famous prophecy. The Lord spoke to his prophet Isaiah about this very development. Let's listen in.
Isaiah, my servant.
Yes, my Lord, I am here.
Take your son, Sha'ar Yashuv, and go out to the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool. You will see King Ahaz there. Go and speak with him.
Yes, my Lord. These are troubled times, and I imagine he is examining the city's defences.
He is, indeed. But give him this word from me. Be careful, but stay calm. Do not be afraid of those who are coming against you. Those two leaders have a fierce, blazing anger against your kingdom. But to me, they are not a raging fire. They are like two smouldering stubs of firewood, soon to go out.
And do they intend to leave us as a barren, deserted wasteland?
No, they intend to invade Judah, to tear it apart and divide it between their two kingdoms. They then intend to set up their own king in my chosen city. He is a man with the name Tabeel.
Who?
Tabeel.
Tabeel, my lord? This is surely a blasphemy. His name seems to mean that God is good, but you, O Lord, are the only God, and he does not speak for you.
Quite right, my faithful servant. But consider his name. Might it not also mean that he is good for nothing?
Yes, my Lord. I see that clearly now. Such a man will never sit on a throne in your chosen kingdom.
Indeed. You are to give Ahaz this word from me. This invasion will not succeed. These kings are only men. They are all good for nothing, and they are no match for me. I am the one in command here, and within 65 years the northern kingdom itself will be shattered and scattered. But stand firm as you trust me, King Ahaz. I demand that you trust me and do not seek to protect yourself against this onslaught. I will not protect you if you also decide to trust in military and political strength, like those kings who come against you. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all.
My goodness, it's all getting very tense.
I know. God's protection is there to be relied on, but will Ahaz trust him?
There's something else that confuses me.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
Watch it. What does Isaiah's son, Sha'ar Yashuv, have to do with anything?
Ah, you remember S-Y?
Yes, S-Y is Sha'ar Yashuv.
Well, he's not really a player in the drama, but he has a strong symbolic presence in the whole thing. His name means a remnant will return.
So when Ahaz sees him at the aqueduct, he will be faced with having to think about what his name means in that situation.
Exactly. He's like a walking prophetic word. Ahaz can either see it negatively, since only a remnant will be left to return to God and God's ways, or he can see it positively, since it means that no matter how devastating the battles, there will be a remnant to return. The alliance will not succeed.
And what about Tabeel?
Who? Oh, Tabeel. Well, that's very clever. In Hebrew, the consonants in a word are the essence of the word, and you can often play with words by changing their vowels. Now, if you pronounce the E vowels at the end of this word Tabeel, you get a word that means something like God is good. But if you change them to an A vowel and pronounce it that way, Tav'al, or something like that, you get a term that signifies something negative. Nothing. Good for nothing.
So it's like God is playing with his name. Oh, I like that. The alliance thought that their plan was a good one and that God would bless them. They thought he was on their side. And so they were happy to say God is good. But God actually thought the whole thing was good for nothing. But tell me, how did Ahaz take it?
We're not told. But it would seem that he was not convinced by the Lord's assurance, because we are later told that the Lord had to encourage him to ask for a sign to convince him. Let's listen in.
Act 7. The Sign of Emmanuel.
Ahaz, my king.
Ah, Isaiah. Have you come again to add pressure to my already unbearable stress?
My king, I come only with a word from the Lord that you must surely hear.
And what is this word?
The Lord has graciously permitted you to ask him for a sign that you are to trust him and him alone in the coming conflict.
A sign? Are we not expected to have faith without need for signs? Is it not frowned upon to have to ask for a sign rather than simply to have faith?
You are quite right, my king. But the Lord is disappointed that you are not showing that you have this faith. He permits you to ask for a sign. So ask him for a sign. It can be whatever manner you wish. This is a great privilege.
No, I will not ask for any sign. I will not put the Lord to the test.
You have already tested the patience of our God, King Ahaz. Do you pretend that you are pious and trusting, trying to impress your advisers and people by saying that you don't need a sign to trust the Lord? You are afraid to trust the Lord. You do not have faith to believe that he can and will save you and your people without the need to protect yourself with an army and strategic plans. You do not have faith.
How dare you speak to me like this?
It is the Lord who speaks to you, my king. You will not test his patience any longer. He is going to give you a sign, even though you refuse to seek one. He so wants you to trust him. Here is the sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel.
What happened then?
What do you mean?
Did the birth of Emmanuel make a difference to Ahaz and Judah at that time?
Well, yes, even though it's not specifically spelled out anywhere. We know that Judah was not conquered by Israel and Aram, and we know that Israel and Aram were ravaged and conquered by the Assyrian Empire some years later, as God willed and as Isaiah also prophesied.
So what was the point of the boy Emmanuel?
It may be the same as with Isaiah's son, Shear Yashuv. Maybe he didn't actually do anything, like leading troops in battle or becoming a prophet and an advisor to the king. But each time Ahaz, or anyone else who knew about him, saw the boy or heard about him, they were reminded that God was with them, as he said he would be. Maybe the gift from God of a helpless baby boy, when people might have been hoping for the gift of a supreme warrior or a political genius, was a reminder to them that God was in complete control of events, and that even babies were safe in Jerusalem under God's protection.
And maybe that's part of the message of the birth of Jesus, the complete Emmanuel, the absolute fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. God is in complete control, and we don't need warriors or professional politicians to find salvation and true security and freedom.
That's possible. Isaiah did go on to give another messianic prophecy just a few chapters later, in which he says that a little child will lead them.
Act 8. Nine Lessons and Carols.
That's amazing. I always just heard that prophecy at Christmas time and took it as a great promise without thinking about the story of how it came about. It's like it was just a verse taken out of a Christmas box at Christmas and then put back in the box till next time.
Well, you won't be alone there. Next time you read the last part of the opening chapter of Matthew's Gospel, you should think about this back story as well. The full power and joy of that prophecy was not exhausted in the days of Isaiah and Ahaz. Centuries later, it was fully fulfilled in the birth of Jesus, who also came into a very broken and violent world to be God with us. The power of the Roman Empire at that time was also no threat to God's sovereignty. And there is still no power that can stand against the power of God in our world. Jesus is still with us. Jesus is still God with us.
Pleased with us in flesh to dwell, Jesus, our Emmanuel. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King. S-Y and Emmanuel, a drama based on Isaiah 7 and 1 Kings 12. Written and directed by Walter Riggins. Edited and engineered by Neil Chappell. The cast. Narrator, Walter Riggins. Interested party, Merrill Archer. The Lord, Neil Chappell. Scene announcer and friend of Rehoboam, Debbie Taylor. Solomon and Rehoboam, Martin Spain. Isaiah, Tom Wilson. Ahaz, Lee Rayner. Jeroboam, Eric Fenwick. Court elder, Kathy Shaw. Music is taken from purpleplanet.com. Hark the Herald Angels Sing, arrangement by Samuel Day. This is a Castlegate production for the Congregational Federation.